Morning, everyone. Welcome to this very interesting session, Removing Inefficiencies in the Life Insurance Value Chain. I'm Jing Teo, your chair for this session. This presentation will seek to explore how we can use analytics and technology to better understand risk, to improve our service offering, and to create a more efficient market across all distribution channels. This presentation will also seek to explore the lessons learned from the industry's response to some of the challenges faced by the life insurance industry in recent years, and how to continue to move forward. The presentation will be for 40 minutes, after which everyone will have the opportunity to ask some questions. And at the end of the presentation, please remember to complete the short presenter feedback survey via the app. Let me introduce our presenters, Tyson and Matthew. Tyson Johnston is the Group Insurance Client Strategy and Solutions Director at Pacific Life Re. Tyson is responsible for the Pacific Life Re's group insurance business, including developing and implementing the insurance strategy, product development, client management, and helping to write and retain profitable group business. Prior to joining Pacific Life Re, Tyson worked at EY as an actuarial consultant working with life insurers across Australia. Matthew Larkin is a director in Pacific Life Re's Client Strategy and Solutions team, helping to manage Pacific Life Re's existing retail business and develop new partnerships in the insurance market. Matthew has 9 years of experience in Australia, the UK, Ireland, and US. After starting his career working in a large UK insurer, Matthew moved into consulting with EY's life actuarial team in Sydney, managing large deliverables and key stakeholders across a wide range of actuarial projects. Since joining Pacific Life Re, Matthew has utilized his client management and actuarial knowledge to help build deep partnerships with clients, develop innovative solutions to client issues, and use technology to improve customer experience in the market. I'll now hand over to Tyson and Matthew.
Thanks, G. First lesson for the day is shorter bio next time. So thanks very much for coming today. Matt and I are talking about removing inefficiencies in the life insurance value chain, and we're going to have a particular focus on technology and analytics. Now, we're going to be talking about technology a lot, so we wanted to see whether we could actually walk the walk as well. We had a number of issues with service in this room. Good start. But we have Wi-Fi. So I'm going to ask everyone to pull out your smartphones, please, and go to Wi-Fi, and you'll be looking for Hilton Honors. Once you find it, pretty easy to remember, the passcode or the access code that should come up is FSF2018, and that should give you access to Wi-Fi. That's a new step for this presentation. We were hoping you'd have 4G. Is that working? Yep, good. Okay, now once you're online, can you please navigate to zetings.com/PLRE? What this will allow you to do is to follow our presentation, and we're also going to ask you some questions, and you'll be able to respond. So we'll be able to see just how many of you actually are going through these steps at the moment. I'll give you just maybe 10 more seconds. And while you're doing that, I'll kick off. So we wanted to...
Sorry.
Yeah. Wi-Fi was difficult to get onto, I think. So we wanted to start with three key messages so that if you take nothing else away from this presentation, you take these away. Our approach at a high level is to try and estimate from our experience, the actual costs and benefits for a number of different technology solutions, all aimed at improving the life insurance value chain. Now, we've tried to avoid the sort of futuristic ideas like robots and machine learning and fintech, all which have their place, But we don't feel we're there yet. There's intermediate steps that we need to implement to actually gather the data before the robots can take over all of us. So the first is that we believe that technology designed to improve the ease of doing business can easily pay for itself. The second is that technology disruption has certainly started. The life insurance industry was quite slow on the uptake, but it has started, and if you don't get on board now, you're likely to be left behind. And the third, the one we always love, is that the customer is always right. Know your customer and tailor your business to them. Hopefully this presentation will show that not all solutions need to be difficult or expensive, and some can actually be easy to obtain. So we're looking at a different kind of value chain. This one really has a customer lens. The first is around ease of doing business, which is all about making it easier for you to transact with your customers. It includes underwriting, it includes sales and distribution. Second is around customer engagement, which is really improving our interaction with our customers throughout the journey. And the third is where we get a little bit more traditional and talk about how to utilise the actuarial control cycle in a product and pricing setting, where we'll be looking at things like retention and dynamic pricing. With that, I'm going to hand over to Matt to talk about ease of doing business.
Hi, everyone. So as Tyson alluded to, so we're looking at ease of doing business as one particular area. So the way we've actually looked at this presentation is more of there's an NMG survey slide about what the current issues are within the market or key topics within the market. So we've taken that particular slide, we've picked out the particular areas that work towards these topics, and then from there tried to work through the problems, the solutions, and then any cost-benefit analysis that we can think of off the back of that. So first off the bat is the ease of doing business. So I guess the key changes that have been happening within this area, in particular around the LIFT reforms. So it's been really beneficial for a lot of the LIFT reforms to go through, but I think there has been some areas where there's been unintended consequences off the back of the LIFT reforms. And I guess with the LIFT and the advice and around technology, we're just trying to work towards where are the impacts, where are the problems of that, where are the solutions after that as well. So I guess the key three areas that we considered as potential consequences off the back of the LIFT reform are around there being less advisors. So the key point being that the education standards and stuff that are required off the back of the LIFT reforms mean that there might be less advisors in the future, and essentially that means potentially less selling of insurance from advisors. As well as that, there's, because the advisor have less incentive and less remuneration, there's a high likelihood that they're going to spend less time on the lower summons insured. So what that essentially means is it's going to create a little bit of a middle market. It's going to have more under insurance in particular areas, and how potentially technology we see as an area where you could work on that and try to reduce the under insurance gap. And then thirdly, so just off the back of advisors selling less business, having less incentives, means that the actual cost base that they're covering is lower, and therefore the cost of selling insurance becomes higher. And we see, as the LIFT reform and with all the Royal Commission stuff, we can see this being an area that's going to only get worse realistically. And what that essentially means is we think the technology would be the best way to try tackle this problem as early as possible, because we see it a problem that's only going to be exacerbated rather than something that's going to go away in the near future. So as far as potential solutions, so we've looked at, from a less advisor's perspective or an efficiency perspective, we see underwriting rules engines as the potential solution there. I'll allude to it more, but consideration of straight-through processing and efficiencies as part of the underwriting process, how that means that advisors will spend less time actually selling the products and therefore have more incentive to actually sell them. For the underinsurance and that kind of middle market, we've considered a potential e-app as an opportunity there for someone to create an app which would allow. It's almost bridging the gap between the group and the retail sides, wherein if someone's more likely to come into the market in the group area, but actually might be underinsured for themselves, and being able to bridge that gap with an EAP or something to that extent. And then thirdly, consideration of administration systems and efficiencies, both from an advisor perspective and an insured perspective, would be worthwhile considering. Just from a reducing the cost overall would allow for the advisors to have more of that benefit, more of the incentive there. I guess we're especially going to focus on the URE side. I think the administration, when we were considering the potential options within that, they weren't seen to be quite as beneficial as we'd expect. So we'll allude to that further within the cost-benefit analysis side. So, So I guess, as we said, this is a pretty interactive presentation, and we're going to try to get as much of your guys' opinion as possible. Whether it's right or not, I'm not sure. So what do you consider the average straight-through processing rate to be in the market? So that's essentially what policies can be sold without any underwriting being done on the policy itself. So hopefully if you guys manage to get onto the Zeedings, we can see some... Okay. I'll give it another second. Okay, so I think I'll move from there. You guys are remarkably right. And I was hoping you were going to get it really wrong, so I go, no, it turns out it's actually not. So it turns out it is about the 15 to 20%. And I guess the key thing that we were trying to focus on with this is it's not that 80 to 85% of cases need to actually see an underwriter. It's really not the case. It's really just inefficiencies within the existing underwriting process means that more and more applications have to go to the underwriter. So what we were considering within the efficiency point, so what we consider to be possible within this is about a 60% straight-through processing rate. And what that essentially means is it's not necessarily that you're laying off underwriters left, right, and centre. It's more so that the other 40% are actual complex claims, actual complex applications, that the underwriter needs to actually consider the more information off the back of that. The rest of them should be going straight through, and there's just so many inefficiencies within the technology that's stopping that from actually happening. Another thing to dwell on this would be that this has nothing to do with the insurer's risk appetite. It's got nothing to do with the fact that, let's just push more and more applications through, even if they really shouldn't go through. We consider all the technology benefits not to be something that needs to be actually referred to the underwriter, but instead it's purely just inefficiencies within the process. So we definitely think that that's an area of improvement. And what that means from an ease of doing business perspective is an advisor who has a much quicker process to go through would allow them to sell more and more business, not only growing the actual market itself, but as well as that potentially taking business from less efficient processes from other companies. So that's the key idea there. And another point off the back of this, the underwriting rules engine type thing, is around the application form. So I don't know how many people within the audience have went through an application form with an advisor recently, but it can be a really arduous process, of which you need to be quite switched on to even answer some of these questions, let alone if you're trying to make this an easier business to sell to people within the market. It can really be quite tricky. So I guess the next interaction point that I had, and hopefully everyone gets this right, is which question you prefer. So if everyone can have a quick read, one of them you potentially can read quickly, the other you might not be able to. and we're going to have another voting on that. So everyone comfortable? They're across which sheet questions which? And so we're going to have a little bit more of a vote. Oh. I'm a little bit conscious that maybe Tyson was the person who threw in the...
Yeah,
Okay. So, yeah, okay. So about an 80-20 split. First of all, I was going to state that it's not my opinion. I'm not suggesting one of these is better than the others because of my particular opinion. It's more so that behavioural economics has actually shown that question two would actually get you the better result. So it's off a few different things. You have simple and focused questions. In fact, I allude to what the particular issues are. So you've got, it's too long and it's difficult to understand for the first particular question. As far as the second question goes, it's well worded, it's simple, and it's focused. So what the actual behavior economics suggests, it's simple and focused questions will pick up better disclosure than long conditionalists. How you ask a question is as important as the words you actually use. And questions that are easily understood are easy to answer. It's kind of a no-brainer in that respect. So we see a particular area of application forms within reducing questions like this could reduce the application time by a third. So by a third, so 33% more efficient. What that essentially means is an advisor has to spend a lot less time asking these questions and has the opportunity to sell more business because of that. The one other point, I was just going to say was, not everyone's going to have the ability to change their application form that easily. I think there was a very simple takeaway, quick win, is most actuaries in the room will not be working at heights. We're not going to be working with dangerous radioactive materials. It legitimately isn't rocket science, so it makes sense that we shouldn't be asked that question, and it could be a quick win from an application form perspective. So, as I mentioned, we're going to work through the costs and benefits of the particular areas. And I had half a mind to actually make this quite interactive in the sense that whether you think it's higher or lower than the actual, but we probably don't have time for that. So, from a cost perspective, we've considered it over a three-year benefit with a three-year period, with a license fee and as well as that just cost of implementation. So we see URE's on average can cost about $1.5 million, but the actual benefit we're seeing is double that, as Tyson alluded to at the start. And what really comes into that is both improving your straight-through processing, but as well as that, just the technology advantages you have over other competitors in the market. As well as that, we've considered it over a three-year period, but it's not as if the benefit disappears at that point. We just expect the rest of the market to almost catch up whenever we get there. So it's a benefit we've considered over that period of time. From an e-app perspective, it's really not overly expensive to create apps anymore. And from an actual technology perspective, I think the hardest part is to link into your pricing process to actually have a good indication of what the price of additional cover would be, but we see that as an easy to do business, not a particularly expensive cost, and there is a benefit to it, and we've considered what that additional sales could be off the back of having that e-app. And as I alluded to earlier, from an administration perspective, it's you could put any number into this box because it sometimes can just explode in prices and it can be very expensive to change your administration system. And we've actually, from our experience, not really seen the benefit there from a technology perspective to be able to improve your processes that much, especially on an easy-doing business perspective. One thing I haven't really alluded to here is all the Royal Commission stuff, all that stuff, reputational risk and operational risk become more and more prevalent. We probably haven't alluded to that within our benefit there, but there still is a benefit from that perspective. So it's a harder one to put a number against. Customer engagement. Nice.
All right. So educating customers and meeting customer needs has never been an easy task. The reality is understanding a customer's needs is challenging, and what they might need now is almost certain to change in just a couple of years. Claims management is arguably the area that we engage most with our customers or our members, and it also obviously a very hot topic in the industry at the moment, where claims is undergoing significant scrutiny. I think it's also fair to say that almost all insurers and trustees would be undergoing some sort of claims transformation progress, a process that's all designed to improve customer outcomes. And technology is going to play a big role in this. And there's some others there that also indicate some of the buzzwords that are the industry is clearly having challenges with around customer engagement. So we should be doing our best to engage our customers at every opportunity. And I've split it into three sort of phases. Initial, which is obviously point of sale, ongoing, which picks up from that point, and completion, which I didn't really know what else to call claim time, so it's effectively claim time. These three phases span across insurance and all distribution channels, but for the sheer fact that group insurance, as everyone knows, has a lot of challenges with awareness and engaging customers, this section of the presentation will have a sort of group insurance lens. So, as I mentioned, in group insurance, there's always been challenges with engaging. Initiatives that will help our members to understand what cover they have and of course, that they even have cover to begin with are certainly welcomed. But I certainly think that this is just a first step. I'd love for us to get to a point where we can provide our members with targeted, relevant and timely communication and to give them a choice. And shortly I'll explore how I think technology might help us do this. It's an interesting one, actually, because the budget announcement that came out about a couple of weeks ago now, there's kind of two schools of thought. One is that we can either solve the awareness problem by just doing just that, solving the awareness program and engaging members, problem and engaging members. And the second is we think we know what they need better than they do, so we will decide for them, which more or less is what's been done. So it's almost admitting that it's too hard to engage members and the budget is proposing to take away cover for certain sections of the member base. On an ongoing basis, engagement obviously shouldn't stop after the initial sale. How many people forget they have cover and are reminded by a premium rate increase that might come through? Greater levels of engagement should focus on demonstrating to the customer the value of having the policy. As an industry, I think we certainly can do better when it comes to claims management. And this has been recognised by our insurers, our trustees, recently with various insurance codes of practice. Ultimately, the aim is to provide a consistent and transparent claim service that has fair and reasonable outcomes and turnaround times. So how can technology help? Well, if we start with initial, these are three phases. Matt talked about an e-app for distribution purposes. It also helps significantly with engagement. Consider an example where you have a new member joining a fund. They're going through the application process and you've asked them some simple questions. You can use those questions to profile them. And you can say something like, someone in your general, typical circumstances might have this much cover, in this case, 400 odd thousand. But by default, you have this much. And then you can make it easy. And this is where the URE and straight-through processing that Matt was talking about becomes really useful, is that you can say, do you want 100? Do you want 200,000 of extra cover? You're going to have to answer a few extra questions. The engagement in that aspect is really, really quite easy. However, I think we can go a lot further than this. As I mentioned earlier, I think we can ask more questions. We can get to know our members, and we can even link into some sort of needs-based calculator and provide some sort of scaled advice. I think this type of application will become far more useful when we're trying to engage with the sections of the business that may be coming opt-in if the proposed changes go through. So now time for my first question. And it may be somewhat of a controversial one. So, do you think, yes or no, thumbs up, thumbs down, there is a place for scaled advice within group insurance? And when you're answering this question, I'd ask if you just ignore legislative impediments that we have for now. might have been that legislation comment that pushed it back up. That's good to see. If you haven't noticed, that's sort of my view as well, is that there is a place. I personally feel that initiatives such as these would result in having a much more informed and engaged member base and cover levels that are ultimately more appropriate to the individual member. And the other benefit, of course, is that we'll remove some of the cross-subsidies that are inherent in our group insurance system. Now, not quite at that yet. We talked about wellness programs, and we had this morning when Andrew was speaking, and I think wellness programs in the market have done really well, but to date, as to the best of my knowledge at least, none of them actually feed back into underwriting, which I think is certainly an opportunity lost in terms of engagement. So I'm a member of one of the more well-known wellness programs in the market that's quite intensive in terms of data collection. But when applying for a retail advised policy, I was given a paper-based application and answered many questions from injuries over a decade ago that could have easily been answered with the data that had been collected. So I think I'm sure that's in the works if it's not already. And I think if we can leverage this information better and improve engagement at these sort of touch points, then it would be really valuable. Now, engaging on an ongoing basis is typically more challenging than at the point of sale, and this is another area where wellness programs have been very beneficial, as we heard this morning. There's been improvements in retention and potentially behaviour changes as well. But the other benefit that's aside from, engaging customers is that it allows you to implement sort of preferred lives pricing strategies where some customers may get discounts that others don't because they might be tracking their exercise better or they might be seen as being more active. Time for the next question. This is a bit different. So this one you need to order from most to least relevant. I'm interested in your thoughts on wellness programs. So I think Vitality's obviously been in the market for a few years. There are a number of others that are doing something similar. There's a couple that link into into wearables. And there are a few that don't link into wearables but provide pricing based on BMI or other factors like that. Just give that a couple more seconds, but it looks like engagement is winning the race at the moment, which is good to see. I hope you guys aren't just doing this for me. I was interested that likely to lead to better claims experience was the second one there. I think that's actually how I would order it as well. So we're all on the same page, which is good to see. Now, the industry has improved markedly in recent years, where members now have the ability to lodge claims through an online portal and to track progress in group insurance. But the industry, I think, is yet to utilise some of the powerful technology that we have from other applications. So underwriting rules engines, for example, have been in the market for a number of years now. So it's surprising that claims automation and claims rules engines are only starting to gain more traction now. Claims automation would provide insurers and trustees with an auditable claims process that is consistent for members. All assessments would be based on rules that are defined by the best assessors, and these claims assessors could be redeployed to areas that they're needed more. So there is capacity to release, but we're suggesting that these assessors are freed up to look at complex claims and, you know, things like mental health claims. Claims turnaround times will also be significantly improved, and straight-through processing should improve things materially. So straight-through processing in a claim sense is effectively where claim is lodged and you can pay straight away, which is important for the next question, which, before you vote, I need to clarify something here. So the question is, what portion of total claims would you be comfortable managing through straight-through processing? What I should have said is, what portion of income protection or GSC claims? Because obviously death would be quite high. I'm interested in your views on GSC. This is an interesting one, because I'd say 2 or 3 years ago, having this conversation, there'd be a lot more in that bucket A than I'm hoping there will be today. So people are seeing the power of the underwriting rules engines, for instance, and are happy that if you can clearly define the rules and you understand how the process is going to be managed, that you can fit within those boundaries. So it looks like the highest is less than 20, but there's still a reasonable number in 20 to 40. I mean, I think when I think about it, you think claims like musculoskeletal, for instance, I think a high portion of those could be managed with straight-through processing. If you think someone has a broken leg, there might be a tradie, you typically know there or thereabouts how long they're going to be off work. And there's no reason that you couldn't, if it's within your risk appetite, push that straight through. Musculoskeletal for some funds make up a significant portion of claims. So even if you got 50% through, you could be looking easily at 20 to 40% claims. All right, now the fun slide. So how do the numbers stack up? As Matt alluded to, this is by no means a precise exercise designed to give you an idea of relativity between cost and benefit. In terms of the e-app, Matt paid for that, so thanks. In terms of the benefit for the e-app, look, it's mostly around additional profit margin on additional policies or additional cover. The interesting one with this, though, is that, look, it's not really designed for financial gain. It's designed for service. So whilst it could be materially higher than that, particularly in the current environment where if you pick up a lot of the under-25s and provide them with cover that otherwise wouldn't have, it could be significant. But at the same time, it's all designed around giving members choice. So it could lead to more members opting out, which my view is that would be a better outcome than what is being imposed by the budget. Wellness is another interesting one where I think let's look at the benefit first. The benefit, as we heard this morning, comes predominantly from how we engage and how we can improve retention. There are also some benefits around improved sales, particularly if it's a differentiator, and the potential for improved claims. Now, the cost there, it could be significant if you're looking at something like a vitality, obviously. My advice would be to look at what benefit you think you can get and start small. There's lots of wellness programs in the market that simply use BMI, for instance. There's no reason that couldn't be a first step. In terms of the CRE, like the URE, the cost is predominantly hosting fees, licensing fees, and implementation. And the benefit is largely capacity release, where claims assessors can be redeployed to areas where they need it more, caseloads can come down, and ultimately the real benefit is the soft benefit in providing a better service to our members and to our customers. Now, I'm going to quickly cover off the first half of product and pricing, and then I'll pass over to Matt. So some words that sort of resonate with product and pricing in the market, obviously industry reputation, profitability, IP product, sustainability is there. Clearly another issue that the industry is grappling with. So retention initiatives are certainly not a new thing. Lapse experience in the retail market was sort of trending north between sort of 2010, 2015. And the most common cause of lapses is always affordability. There's also advisor churn, which Matt would have talked about when he talked about LIF. But a lot of insurers since then have implemented retention teams and retention initiatives that have actually been quite successful. However, we think that there is more that can be done with sophisticated analytics and modelling. The strategy also obviously recognises that retention teams cost money and it's not feasible to contact every single policyholder. So we've broken it up into more or less a proactive and a reactive approach. The proactive approach is really about having a better understanding of your lapse experience and your drivers of lapse experience. The reactive approach is a little bit different and it utilises the data that hopefully has been collected by these retention teams to determine the drivers of policy retention. So which policies are more likely to be retained if you reach out to them and say, you've just cancelled your policy, why, what can we offer you? It should also help to explain which of those initiatives are more worthwhile So is it a premium discount? Is it reducing cover levels? Is it turning off indexation? Is it a premium holiday? Whatever it might be, it will help you understand what strategies you should employ throughout the rest of the business. Now, how do we understand, or how do we get a better understanding? I think we need to do that. We need to look past simple one-way analysis. Our general insurance cousins have been using generalized linear modeling. I can't even say it right. Generalized linear modeling. They've probably been doing it wrong for a long time. And I think we should be leveraging that more and more now. And I think a lot of the industry is starting to move that way for retention modeling. And it's certainly a better way to understand the drivers of this experience and the drivers of policy retention. The last point I'll make is that the data from our underwriting rules engines should also feed into this. This should be seen as a rich source of information. Now I'll quickly pass over to Matt to finish up. Thank you.
Yeah, so I actually was very happy when Andrew from Discovery mentioned dynamic pricing this morning, because I was tempted just to go, what he said, yeah, that sounded about right. So I guess from a dynamic pricing perspective, what am I actually talking about here? Well, it's the ability to be more, well, essentially reactive with your actuarial pricing if need be, or alternatively proactive with it, in the sense that you want to be able to change prices pretty quickly. And I guess the three key components that I'd considered for this is actually better understanding what the risk that you're faced with the actual policy, and being able to have the data there to say, okay, so we're actually making losses on this particular policy. How do we change the price accordingly off the back of that? And you could pick a number of different areas in the market, whether it be step and level, whether it be between different IP type policies, that having a more dynamic pricing would allow you to be more engaged with that and being able to actually change it. The second point really alludes to what I was talking about earlier, was around the underwriting rules engine. There's a plethora of data within that that just doesn't ever feed through to the pricing, or it doesn't tend to feed through very often. So being able to use as much of that information as possible to have the most accurate price possible. And then I guess thirdly is around the price elasticity, but in particular, if you want to be quite competitive and if you want to be reactive to your competitors changing their prices. And I guess the key point from this is so that you are not left holding the worse lives. You're not missing out on your target market because your pricing processes take so long to update that you just can't be... You get left behind if your technology isn't up to speed, is essentially what I'm alluding to. So I guess as far as what that actually means is improving your systems around your pricing processes would allow for quicker turnaround times on your prices and allow you to be more elastic with what you can do in that. So I guess the next kind of point is around the cost and benefits, similarly to the other sections. So Tyson walked you through what the retention would entail as far as potential benefits. So I think from a cost perspective, we've said there is a benefit to working on your retention, and mainly that's we've taken a proportion of the market where you've reduced your lapse rate, reduced your lapse rate. So essentially you've retained more business, and we see that as an obvious benefit. The dynamic pricing, on the other hand, we've put as a cost neutral exercise, and the main reason for this is every company has very different pricing processes. Every company has very different technology solutions and what they can and cannot do. The benefit from changing your pricing could be astronomical. You could be really picking out the pockets of the market that they're underutilized, and there's profitability there. Alternatively, you could be the kind of company who just isn't willing to move where competitors are going, is more risk adverse, whatever it may be. You could change your whole pricing process and not be willing to move into the sectors where there is the profit, and therefore the benefit is almost zero. So there's different ways of looking at it. It's still a beneficial thing, but from an actual cost-benefit perspective, we can't say, hand on our hearts, this is going to pay for itself twice over. So that brings us to the end of our presentation. As Tyson mentioned at the start, we wanted to have three key takeaway from your perspective, so that you aren't just leaving the room and thinking. We were trying to avoid the kind of pie in the sky type ideas, and by all means, people should have those ideas, but this presentation isn't where you'll get them. So I guess to just recap on what we were discussing, so ease of doing business, we consider especially the URE and the eApp perspective could really pay for itself two times over, at least. Technology disruption has started. If you don't get on board, you'll be left behind. And thirdly, begrudgingly, the customer is always right. So know your customer and tailor your business to them. So that really alludes to Tyson's section in particular. I'm just going to leave it there and take some time for some questions.
Thanks, so Tyson and Matthew, for a very interesting and engaging presentation. So it's now to ask questions. So if for people who want to have questions, can you please proceed to the mic in the middle? And please state your name before you ask the question. Thanks. Anyone want to start?
Surely someone wants to query the numbers in the slide.
This question on the Z-teams.
Can you?
Okay.
You want to, yeah.
Hello, I'm Lawrence. So I see in your cost-benefit analysis that your eApp is one of the cheapest investments with the greatest rewards. So why haven't the insurers done it yet? I mean, in this day and age, creating an app, I don't see it as an issue.
A lot have. I think it's taking the next step. So I'd say there's probably two main areas where they can improve. One is leveraging a better URE. That's the easy one. So if the process of taking information from the eApp into a URE and turning around an outcome, if that's better, then it's more useful. And the other is using it to engage better. So a lot won't push out questions and store information. So you're not really getting to know your customer. If you have a very defined task, it can work quite well. So for instance, in group, it's not uncommon for most funds to have some application. It doesn't need to be an actual app. It can be just a web browser where it might say, do you want to increase cover? And then it'll push you out to an insurer's underwriting website or something. It's not contained within. So it's a fair point, and I 100% agree. So some are doing it. I think there's just it's quite easy to do it better. And there's a lot of value in it.
Okay. Thank you.
Providing the response because it's recorded.
Thanks for the presentation. My name is Jun. Just have a question. So empathy is obviously a very important part of life insurance. And one of the, I guess, not I don't want to say risk, but one of the matters that insurers should consider is how to balance between getting more efficient, automated, versus getting the customer engaging, empathy, personal interaction. So can you share your ideas as to how you can balance between the two? Thanks.
I'd say that's more from a claims perspective, so I'll take that. Again, good question and agree, particularly appropriate in the current environment. I think it's an easy one, though. So I think we came up with 20 to 40% was probably most likely, or maybe it was less than 20. You obviously focus your claims management on the claims that where empathy isn't as important. So, for instance, if you've got a mental health claim, that's more likely that you're not going to manage that straight through. You'd manage it with rules to a certain point, and then claims assessors will become more and more important. And as we pointed out, we're certainly not suggesting from an underwriting or a claims perspective that we're replacing bodies. People are really core to the business, particularly when it comes to things like empathy. So people will understand people, machines won't. So we're not suggesting that by capacity release we're actually removing people, we're just removing them to where they need it more, which is exactly the areas that you're talking about.
Yeah,
Hi, Mark Schneider. I noticed on your slide there was a big gap in the cost between the e-app and changing admin systems. I think you had $2.5 million. There is potentially, there's something in between that you can do, which is automation through RPA, robotic process automation, which sits on top of the existing systems, but automates a lot of the processes that humans would otherwise do. It's also a way to dip a toe in the water and get experience with the automation before you invest the $2.5 million plus dollars. So there is definitely a way to do that. And certainly, you know, RPA is growing globally at about 50 plus percent per annum. And I think some insurers are trying it out. But that is potentially a fourth category you could add in as a way to get that automation. And the automation can also help the intermediaries because they're under a lot of strain at the moment, as we've seen, and allow them to focus on their real value add but take away a lot of the mechanical parts of their work.
Yeah, no, that's a very fair point, and thank you for that. It probably wasn't part of our consideration just now is because we tried to consider where we think the market could be. Today, it is something that going forward we see being a benefit, and we did allude to the fact that there is an area for the AI stuff, the machine learning, the robotics, but it's potentially, we feel like the URE and the e-app, for example, on the ease of doing business section are a bit more developed at this stage to say, if you realistically rocked up to a board tomorrow and said, look, we think this is what the cost will be, and we actually have a firm benefit, and there's figures in the market as to what that's going to look like, we've seen it as more of an intermediate step, but a step that could get over the line. Obviously, robotics is going to move forward more in that discussion, but it was probably an area that we weren't as across, I guess, in that respect.
I think we've run out of time, so I'd like to thank Tyson and Matthew again for the very interesting and engaging presentation. Please join me to thank both of them again.